We hope you find this WILL podcast to be valuable. A $10 voluntary credit card contribution at willpledge.org will help us continue to make podcasts of our programs available. Thank you. And that address again is willpledge.org. WILLPLEDGE.ORG. Now here's your program.
And good morning. Welcome to Focus 580. This is our morning talk program. My name's David Inge, and we're glad to have you with us. Some of today's most popular television dramas revolve around the work of forensic scientists who use technology to solve crimes. And certainly in the real world, these scientists have become very important in the whole law enforcement process, the business of investigating crimes and trying to figure out who are the guilty parties. At the same time, there is some concern that maybe when real people are called to serve on real juries, they bring with them unreal expectations about what forensic science can do. And some people have dubbed this the CSI effect, taking off from the name of the popular TV show, CSI. So this morning, we'll start and maybe talk a little bit about that and talk about how juries may or may not be swayed by what they see on television. Perhaps also we'll talk a little bit about what we know about forensic science and maybe whether we've put too much faith in some of these techniques, some of them things like fingerprints, for example, that we have been using for a long, long time. But our guest for the program is Simon Cole. He is associate professor at UC Irvine, University of California, Irvine, in the Department of Criminology, Law, and Society. And in his work, he's particularly interested in the interaction between science, technology, law, and criminal justice. And he's here visiting the campus to give a talk on this subject, Forensic Reality, CSI, Media, and Public Technoscience. And this is part of an initiative of the Center for Advanced Study Interpreting Technoscience, Explorations in Identity, Culture, and Democracy. And this talk takes place at 4 o'clock this afternoon in the Knight Auditorium. That's at the Spurlock Museum on South Gregory in Urbana. And these programs are always free and open to the public, so people who are interested or in and around Champaign-Urbana can stop by and hear more of what he would have to say. And, of course, we're pleased to have him here on the program to talk about some of the same things. And we'd entertain questions. We hope people can keep their questions brief and keep them on the topic, but certainly people are welcome to call in. 333-9455 is the number here in Champaign-Urbana, and toll-free, 800-222-9455. Anyone at any point here, welcome to join the conversation. Thanks very much for being here.
Thank you for having me.
I'm interested in starting out and talking a little bit about this thing that has been called the CSI effect. And before we go on to perhaps talking about why it might be a problem, or whether, in fact, it exists at all. What is it really that we're talking about here?
Well, one of the things about it is that we're not quite sure that people use the term to mean very different things. I think where the CSI effect starts is that it's important to recognize that there have been actually great changes and developments in forensic science over the past couple decades or so, the best known of which is, of course, the development of DNA profiling, but lots of other technical advances as well. So there have been real changes and advances in forensic science. That then became the subject of a television show, which for the first time was able to make the science the center of the show rather than the old-fashioned gumshoe kind of detection work. Then what's happened is that the popularity of those shows, CSI, its spin-offs, and its imitators, has begun to be construed as kind of a problem for the justice system, which is kind of a counterintuitive and ironic thing that that these shows feature forensic science.
Yeah.
The problem specifically when people talk about a problem is that supposedly juries are biased by these shows and come to expect there to be forensic science available in every case and therefore refuse to convict people if there is not forensic science in the particular case in front of them. So the argument is that we are now suffering from what might be called wrongful acquittals. You've heard of wrongful convictions. These are wrongful acquittals, juries that are acquitting because of the absence of forensic science. But it's important to note that one of the things I've noticed is people use the term CSI effect to mean all sorts of things and just to refer to the impact of the show in general. So it's important to disentangle what it is we mean when we talk about the CSI effect.
And I guess as I have read about it, the way that I think about it is what you pointed to, is that juries have come to – people who serve on juries have come to expect that real-life forensic science can do what they have seen the forensic scientists do on the television shows, which seems like always to provide good, solid answers and to tell you who the guilty party is and to tell you about how crimes were committed and that what happens then if you can't give an actual jury that kind of real solid evidence, then that raises enough doubt in their minds so that they will say, well, Mr. Prosecutor, Ms. Prosecutor, you haven't proven your case because you can't give me ironclad scientific evidence that shows that the accused is really guilty.
Yes, that's right. That is the allegation of what the CSI effect is. And it certainly does seem true that science as depicted on CSI is a kind of mythologized, idealized notion of what science is, that science produces clear, unambiguous answers to questions that you pose to it. And one of the ironies of this is I think if you went to any of the many, many practicing scientists on this campus and said, is science all about producing clear, unambiguous answers to the questions that you pose for yourselves? They would find that pretty funny. Science yields ambiguous data that requires theory to be interpreted and kind of begins to place limits on uncertainty, but it doesn't produce kind of crystal clear answers the way it does on CSI.
And that is something I think, generally speaking, as far as science goes, something that is a problem in the popular mind, because people, I think, don't really quite understand that whatever it is that you're talking about, whether you're talking about someone who committed a crime or whether you're talking about global climate change or whatever it is, that science doesn't always come up with such clear-cut answers. And there are still more questions than there are answers. And I think people don't understand that. And so it frustrates them when science gives them ambiguous answers about whatever the subject is. Somehow they think, well, you scientists, shouldn't you be able to answer me a yes or no question? And unfortunately, that's just not the way science is.
Yes. I mean, I think there's a kind of popular equation of the notion of science with certain knowledge. Science is knowledge that's completely unambiguous and certain. And again, practicing scientists would find that kind of strange.
Well, clearly, the people in the justice system, I'm sure judges and attorneys and everyone who's connected with it, they're concerned about this thing. They're concerned that the CSI effect is real. What have they done, or have they done certain things, started to do things differently that reflects that concern?
Well, some of the things that have been done is that the players in the criminal justice system, like you mentioned, attorneys and judges and so on, can take countermeasures, especially the attorneys. So prosecutors, who are the ones who are primarily worried about the CSI effect, can do things like question jurors during voir dire about what kind of television shows they watch. That, I think, probably is less effective than simply explaining the absence of evidence when it's necessary. Mm-hmm. So if they are worried that the jury is going to acquit the person because no fingerprints were found, they can put on a witness to say, we looked for fingerprints and we didn't find them, and it's completely normal for every time you touch something, you don't necessarily leave a legible fingerprint. And so there's nothing strange about this and nothing suspicious about it. It's called negative evidence testimony. You put on a witness to explain the absence of evidence. And there's nothing wrong with doing that.
And I expect that on their side, that defense attorneys do everything they can to raise doubts in the minds of jurors about whether or not these methods are accurate.
They can do both. I mean, in the case of the absence of evidence, they are, to some extent, ethically bound to try to use that argument to say, hey, if my client did it, there would have been fingerprints there and there aren't any. And then the prosecutor will have to rebut that with the witness. Yes, the defense attorneys have their own version of the CSI effect, which is in fact the opposite of the prosecutor's version. And their version gets much less play in the media. But their version is in some sense the more intuitive version. It says, hey, the most popular show on television portrays forensic scientists in extremely positive light as hardworking, virtuous, and indeed good-looking characters. We think the prosecution's witnesses benefit from this show. It makes them look good in the same way that doctors looked good when ER was a popular show and lawyers looked okay when LA Law was a popular show. So they argue that CSI actually hurts them.
Let me just very quickly introduce again our guest, Simon Cole. He's from the Department of Criminology, Law, and Society at University of California, Irvine. He's very interested in how science, technology, law, criminal justice all work together. And we're talking a little bit about here about how people feel about forensic science, that is the kind of technology that's applied to trying to solve crimes, and how the way this is depicted on television, how that affects the popular imagination, and how that may or may not affect how people think if they might happen to be selected to be on a jury and actually be in a real trial and dealing with real-world forensic science. It's a subject of that he's been interested in and has written on and will be talking on later today on the U of I campus. So we'll tell you more about that later. The questions here are welcome, though, 333-9455 and toll-free 800-222-9455 if you'd like to call in and join the conversation. Well, let me come to the big question now, and that is we've talked a little bit about this, what's called the CSI effect, and some of the concerns that people have about it. Is it real?
Well, I think we don't know. And if you look at the media, it's treated as real and as a major problem. And again, I think it's important to disentangle what different people mean by the CSI effect. So some people mean by it, because of the show, prosecutors are taking the countermeasures that we just discussed. They're putting on negative evidence testimony. To that extent, it probably is real. Prosecutors are changing their behavior. But the real key CSI effect that you hear the most about and that is supposedly the most dangerous is the effect on jurors, is that jurors are changing their behavior. They're acquitting in cases in which they would have convicted had no one ever created a show called CSI. Mm-hmm. Now, that's a pretty strong claim to say that a TV show is causing acquittals to occur. And the evidence on that is pretty thin. There's some anecdotes where prosecutors say it happened in their case, but that's not very trustworthy evidence. One of the parties who litigated a case giving you an explanation as to why they lost. Mm-hmm. So and in terms of other evidence, it's pretty thin so far.
Well, and it seems to me that would be actually a rather difficult question to answer. I mean, ideally, I suppose, if you're going to apply the scientific method, you'd have to try the same case with two different juries in one case using the forensic evidence, or if you could find some people who had never seen CSI, you know, the kinds of classic experiment, and actually run two trials and have two different juries and see, would the outcome be different? I mean, you can go back afterwards and you can interview jurors after the trial's concluded and after a verdict has been rendered, and you could say to them, well, why did you either vote to acquit or why did you vote to convict, and see if you can tease some of that stuff out. But you never really – I'm not sure there's a good way to actually to come up with an answer to the question.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, the best way to do an experiment, which you just described, is not really possible. Yeah. So what people have done, some psychologists have done experiments where they've divided people into watchers and non-watchers and given them mock trials and tried to measure whether the watchers are more acquittal prone. Some researchers have done surveys of jurors and asked them questions. Those studies have yielded kind of – some have found no effect. Some have found a very small effect. They really don't support a strong conclusion that there's this effect going on. The work that I've done is to try to look at actual acquittal rates historically over time and see if there's been some kind of bump. after the creation of CSI. And that's a little bit difficult to disentangle, too, because it goes up and down without CSI. But again, there doesn't seem to have been a noticeable jump in acquittals in all the years following CSI.
Yeah. Well, and I would also expect that because there would have been media coverage of actual trials using forensic evidence, and people would have read those stories, that you're going to have an effect there as well, particularly because we've heard so much about DNA evidence and DNA evidence being used to overturn or to raise questions about convictions. I would expect that just even reading the newspapers might well affect how people think about evidence and what's good evidence and what's not, and that having an effect on how they might decide if they were on a jury.
Yeah. Well, that raises two things. I mean, I think you're right. What makes this even more complicated now is that we're beginning to enter sort of the era of the CSI effect, where people have – now you try to study people and they've spent the last 5 years reading articles in the newspaper about how there's this CSI effect and there's a big problem. The second point you made, which was what?
Well, I guess I'm thinking – I maybe didn't state it clearly enough. I guess I'm thinking that even if there was no dramatic – depiction of forensic science, there would be in the media articles about real forensic science and real trials and about how various kinds of evidence was used, DNA in particular, so that maybe people would still have a certain set of expectations that would come from the real world quite apart from dramatic depictions of forensic science.
Yeah, that's right. In some sense, we have to disentangle the CSI effect, which is the effect of this TV show, from what a judge in Michigan named Donald Shelton has called the tech effect, which is the effect of the actual changes. I mean, have actually been changes. DNA has been developed. It didn't exist 30 years ago. And so in some sense, it's appropriate for there to be an effect of that, for jurors to change how they think about evidence. And the other – this reminds me of the point I was going to make. If the effect is that it causes jurors to think a little bit more carefully about evidence, it's not clear that that's a bad thing.
Yeah, or that it should compel prosecutors to have to make a case for – why a certain method or piece of evidence is good and reliable. And I suppose always defense attorneys have always been challenging evidence, so maybe that would be happening anyway.
Yeah.
We have a couple callers here to talk with. Let us do that. We'll start with someone in Mahomet, not too far away. This is line number one. Hello.
Yeah, a question. Is there any evidence that the criminals are changing their behavior because of the CSI factor? And it seems like I heard or read or something where the maybe the rape cases have gone down, or the rapist may be scared, you know, because they might get caught now more easily. And I thought that's kind of a powerful factor. I'll get off. Thank you.
Right. Any evidence that somehow people might be, if I hear the caller correctly, less inclined to commit a crime because they would be more fearful that they'd be caught?
Yes, that is another one of the supposed CSI effects. Another way the term is used is it's an effect on criminals in that they change their behavior in order to evade detection. There's no real social scientific evidence for or against that. There's just anecdotes. And I'm not sure how you would study that. There is one study by a colleague in Europe, Barbara Prainsock, who's interviewed convicts about their views of DNA, and it does support. They view DNA as very powerful evidence and something that has to be evaded. But in some sense, the idea that of a CSI effect on criminals presupposes a lot of rationality and planning on the part of criminals, which may apply to some, but certainly doesn't apply to all of them.
Our number here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455, and toll-free, 800-222-9455. I'd like to go on to something else that I know that you have written about that I think is quite interesting, and that is fingerprints. And it seems to me that, say, before DNA, the thing that some people would have said was about the most reliable kind of forensic science we had, maybe the first real modern thing to come along, was fingerprint. And here's this idea that everyone's fingerprints are unique, and if you can get a good fingerprint that can tie a suspect to a place, to a crime, to a murder weapon, and that was one of the best things that we had. But I know this is something that you've written about, and that in fact there are a lot of questions even now, today, there are a lot of questions about just how accurate fingerprints are, or maybe it's the business of taking and interpreting and matching a person to a print. There are a lot of questions about that.
Yes, that's right. The story is, which I tell if I can plug my book briefly, in the new book Truth Machine, which came out last year from University of Chicago Press with my co-authors, is that as DNA is developed in the late 80s and early 1990s, and there are a lot of court challenges to DNA, a lot of those hash out how they can statistically characterize the evidentiary importance of a DNA match, among lots of other issues like laboratory contamination and so on. As those issues are hashed out during the 1990s, people begin to turn around and say, well, what would the answers be if we asked these same questions about fingerprints, which has been around for nearly a century? It turns out that they don't use statistics or probabilities at all. And that causes people to ask questions. Well, why not? Isn't this evidence probabilistic in the same way that DNA evidence is? And so in an odd sort of way, it begins to turn the spotlight back onto fingerprints as people begin to demand, well, what is the statistical basis for these matches? And that requires research that has not yet been done. The major event in this area is the release of a National Academy of Sciences report that came out just in February, stating that this research needed to put fingerprints on the same sort of statistical basis that DNA is on has still not yet been done.
Hmm. Why, given that people have been using fingerprints for such a long time, why has that not been done?
Well, I think it's a number of reasons. I think that we did not think about evidence in the same way in 1910 when fingerprinting was new as we did in 1990 when DNA was new. And so it was clear that DNA should be thought about probabilistically and statistically in a way that it wasn't back in 1910. In addition, when fingerprinting came along, it was readily accepted by the courts, allowed into evidence, and allowed to make extremely strong claims, and claims that the defendant is the only possible source of a particular print. That then created a disincentive to do any research because you're allowed to make the strongest possible claims you can make in court. Why would you want to do any more research? It's not going to do you any good. It might do you some harm in that if it finds out that the claims you're making are too strong and they should perhaps be ratcheted down a little bit.
Yeah. Well, you know, that leads to the question, and maybe the answer is that it hasn't been done. But if, for example, we had a fingerprint from a crime scene and we have a suspect and we take that suspect's fingerprints and then we take the suspect's print, the print from the crime scene, set them side by side, and then we bring in some fingerprint analysts, people whose job it is to say, is it the same person or not? And say, you know, maybe we bring 10 different people, mm-hmm. have each of them look at the two prints, and then say, all right, do they match or do they not? Would we get 10 out of, would they agree 10 out of 10 or 7 out of 10 or 5 out of 10?
Well, I don't know the answer to that because studies like that have not been done. A study like that would be useful. Mm-hmm. The other studies that are missing would be a sort of basic accuracy study. Well, instead of 10, let's just ask about one. When they reach a conclusion, how often is it correct and how often is it incorrect under controlled conditions in which we knew the correct answer? And Then another question would be the population question, like we ask for DNA. And given that this crime scene print and the one from the suspect appear consistent to the examiner, fine. That's fine that they appear consistent. But how many other images might there be, print images might there be in the world that might also appear consistent? Well, they say they know the answer is zero, but they don't actually have a scientific study that tells them that.
Mm-hmm. Well, and I'm sure that the business of fingerprints is not always so clear cut, and the fingerprints you get off a crime scene may be blurry, they may be smudged, they're not made under laboratory conditions. So I'm sure that sometimes the evidence is not as clear as you would like. You have human beings, so people are subject to make errors. I think it's just interesting that it may be that we've always sort of said this is an ironclad kind of thing, going back to the idea that. That everyone's fingerprint is so different that there would be no chance of making a mistake.
Yes, that's right. So there is a lot of variety in the quality of prints. And so the experiment that you sort of briefly described was a little too simple because we'd have to vary the quality of the prints. And presumably there would be much better accuracy with high-quality prints than with low-quality prints.
Well, I suppose it also would be a better experiment would be for us to take a sample of prints, some that were matches and some that weren't, and take an individual person and sit them down and test them where we know, which are matches and which aren't. And then we would see, well, how well does that person do in matching up the ones that match and saying that these others don't?
Yes. Although, again, we'd want to see on which quality prints they do well and which ones they do poorly.
Is this something that I would think this would be something where technology could be applied so that you get the human element out of it? And can you teach a computer to read fingerprints?
Yes, there are computers that, again, we're back to CSI again. They do not, as depicted on CSI, make matches. But what they are used for is as search tools, sort of like Google. They will search the database for the most likely candidates, and then they will then stick those candidates up in front of the human examiner.
So you're still relying on the person to make the final call.
That's correct. Just as Google does pretty well at putting what you're looking for on that first page of 10 hits, but the first hit is not always what you want.
We have another call here. Let's talk with somebody, I believe, on our line number one. Hello.
Hi. I was trying to decide whether it was a digression to bring up again in the broader idea of how media and law enforcement have interacted, the idea that J. Edgar Hoover had a blue pencil. He could basically control the portrayal of his men in both G-Men and the early TV show FBI. It's a pretty amazing story. Kind of makes you wonder about what Hollywood was really about in those days, but and the media production. But I just had to ask, because what is the antecedent when you used you earlier? Why would you want to investigate the validity of fingerprints? I mean, who is the you? Is it the Department of Justice who aren't the Department of Convictions? They're the Department of Justice. Wouldn't think that they would be interested in. I mean, do you get what I'm getting at? Because you just rather ambiguously said, well, you wouldn't want to disturb it because it's working for you now. I mean, if you don't know it's working for you now in the sense of bringing you a just conviction, then you don't know. I'm a little bit getting a little apoplectic about it, actually. So what do you have to say about that?
Yeah, I think the question is, when I said there was no incentive for you to do the research, the question is who would do the research? Who would have done the validation studies of, say, fingerprint identification over the past century? And I think the caller is right. The problem is that there wasn't really a you. So people who do fingerprinting for a living, latent print practitioners, they work full-time. They're very busy doing fingerprint analyses. They don't have time to do a scientific validation study, nor are they trained or prepared to do such a thing.
Well, I'm asking about the Department of Justice then. Wouldn't one think that they would be the who it would fall upon to decide if this new or even someone appointed by the courts to decide? I mean, there must be some kind of adjudication of accepting testimony and types of testimony. We hear about that in some other instances, and in DNA particularly. I'm still at a loss. It seems to me that it's the whole mindset that, you know, the authorities, of course, are disinterested, and they are interested in justice, and it isn't like they want to pump up their conviction rate for the next election or things like that. Obviously, they do have all those impulses that have led us to where we are now, which is the most incarcerated country in the world. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think you can legitimately ask why the Department of Justice didn't fund such a study over the past century. In fairness, the National Institute of Justice over the last couple of years has now dedicated a fair amount of funding to research in the kind of pattern recognition forensic sciences. And this is a relatively new initiative.
Well, I guess the question would be, would it be fair to say that as far as the law enforcement community in the largest possible sense was concerned, they would have said, well, this works just fine. Why do we even need to raise this question? We think that it works just fine.
I think that is what they think. And I think probably in fairness to them, they thought by that they meant we think it's highly accurate and we don't need to worry about it. On the other hand, from a sociological point of view, it did work fine for them. It did get them convictions, and courts didn't give them any trouble about it.
Yeah. Let me very quickly introduce again our guest for this hour, Simon Cole. He is associate professor at University of California, Irvine in the Department of Criminology, Law and Society. And in his work, he's interested in how science, technology, law, and criminal justice all work together, and also, of course, how media is involved. He's here on the campus to talk about the sometimes what has been called the CSI effect. We talked about that a little earlier in the show. That is the way that juries might be influenced by the kind of dramatic depictions they see of the modern forensic science and the way that it's used in criminal cases. He'll be talking about this in a talk. This is as part of a Center for Advanced Study initiative, Interpreting Technoscience. This is this afternoon on the U of I campus, 4 o'clock, in the Knight Auditorium of the Spurlock Museum. Anybody who wants to stop by is welcome. And, of course, here on the program, questions welcome too, 333-9455, toll-free, 800-222-9455. I guess as a kind of a general question, having now been talking about these various kinds of techniques that we've talked about, I wonder whether one might say that even going back, you know, maybe 100 years to the point where we're starting to have modern science applied to criminal investigation, whether it would be going too far to say that the degree of confidence that we've put in these methods may be a little too high.
Well, I think that the the lesson to take away is to be wary of putting unbridled confidence into any kind of scientific claim or technical process or anything like that. When someone is claiming that something is infallible and error-free, one should be suspicious. And that, I think, is one of the lessons of the fingerprint story, where it literally claims were made that it was infallible. And that clearly is not true, whatever may be said in favor of fingerprinting, and it may well be a very, very accurate technique and certainly a very useful technique. But infallible it is not. And what I hope does not happen is that we just simply discard the old supposedly infallible technology in favor of the new one, which of course is DNA, and is beginning to advance the same claims, but instead say, well, last time we were told something was infallible, it wasn't right, so let's be a little bit skeptical this time. Again, despite whatever may be said in favor of DNA, which is, again, probably a very accurate and useful technique.
Well, so do you think, though, that people have an unwarranted high-level confidence in DNA?
I certainly think you see claims out there. The name of the book that I alluded to before is Truth Machine, and that was meant to be ironic. So you certainly do see claims out there that it is some sort of truth machine and that there can't be anything wrong with it. And so if DNA, you know, implicates you in something, but there are all these other reasons why that might be wrong, you know, we need to have some skepticism. There still can be errors in using this technology. There can be contamination errors. There can be interpretation errors.
Yeah. We're coming to the point here. We have maybe about 15 minutes left. So certainly questions, comments, participation by people who are listening, that's welcome. 333-9455 and toll free 800-222-9455. I'm not sure that this is something that an area that you're interested in. And maybe I'll just ask. It seems that juries are getting more and well, I suppose from the point of view of prosecutors and judges, maybe getting more and more difficult to manage. That is, people are maybe they're stubborn, maybe they're independent-minded, maybe they want to go beyond the bounds of what they are told they're supposed to be considering. I'm thinking, for example, about some of the concerns that have been raised in the last year or so about people serving on juries who apparently are ignoring the instruction of judges that they're not supposed to seek out any information about the case, you know. And we have these stories of people in the jury room using their BlackBerries to Google stuff that has to do with the trial, where clearly that is not what they're supposed to do, and they're only supposed to consider the evidence that is presented, and they're not supposed to be talking about it, you know, all the standard sort of thing that the juries are told. And I think some people have raised some questions about, well, is this a serious problem, and what do you do about it?
Mm. Well, certainly I'm not an expert on the kind of this trend of the webifying of the jury or, you know, how new communications technologies are affecting juries. But, you know, the jury is a very fraught topic for social scientists and for legal scholars. We know very little about what juries do because there have historically been restrictions on studying them. Only recently have a few researchers been able to actually send researchers in to observe actual jurors deliberating. So in general, it's been what social scientists call a black box. They go in that room and they come out with an answer, and we don't know what goes on in there except to simulate the process with college students, which is not quite as good. So they may be doing – in fact, we can be pretty sure that they're doing all sorts of things that they shouldn't be doing in there, and we only hear about it when it becomes really egregious, like somebody starts pulling out a Bible or something. Yeah. Now, that said, I think the world is changing around jurors. So with things like access to the web and things like that. So technology is changing around them. I think – and so social scientists are divided as to whether they have a lot of faith in juries or they think we're crazy to rely on 12 ordinary people and we should have experts do this. But the people who feel good about jurors, I think the argument would be that even if the world is changing – under them, people do take it really seriously. And to change their outcome, to have them decide to let someone walk free or to put someone in prison, that's not going to change so much because of these minor changes around the edge, whether it's what they watch on TV or whether they have access to the web, because that's a very serious moral decision made by 12 people. And one would hope it's not so sensitive that it changes because of what TV shows people watch.
So this may be going beyond the area of your research, but in all of these things that have been raised as problems, whether it's people who are, you know, don't or unwilling to deliberate or have problems with the way they behave in the jury room, or that they're seeking information in addition to what's been presented in the trial, any and all of that, is the argument made that, in fact, ultimately what jurors are trying to do is they're trying to come up with the right decision, and they don't want to convict someone who is not guilty, or maybe they want to make sure they do convict someone who is. And what they're trying to do is, every way they can, try to get as much information as they can to come up with the right decision.
Sure. I mean, I've been on a jury myself, and I have felt the lack of information. Some people listening may have been on juries as well. And so you know that you'll be sitting there and the attorneys and judges will go and talk outside of your hearing and they'll be waving their arms around. So you know that there's clearly something important that they're talking about and you wish you had that information. And it feels very unfair to be deprived of that information. So I think the urge to have more information is understandable, but there are legal rules that prohibit the inclusion of some information. And then, do you want people surfing the web? Because we don't know the quality of that information either. It ends up being trial by innuendo and rumor.
All right, let's talk with some of the folks here. Savoy is next. Line one. Hello.
Hello?
Yes. Go ahead. Line one, Savoy, go ahead.
Here I am.
Yes, go ahead.
I'm wondering if people on the prosecution side of the justice system might not be reluctant to look into the question of whether or not fingerprints are reliable evidence, because that might lead to a great, great many attempts to reverse past prosecutions.
Yes, that might be a concern. Certainly, I think the prosecutor is the person with the least incentive to want to see research done. It's now an extremely useful technique for them to use at trial. It makes claims of absolute certainty, of infallibility, and is allowed to do so by the courts. I think the practitioners have more incentive to do the research because they actually do the technique. So I think prosecutors may be concerned about, as you mentioned, the reopening of old cases, although it's debated how many such cases would actually be open, because it would have to be a case that really hinged only on the fingerprint evidence. And there are some of those cases, but not as many. And they may also be concerned about its usefulness in securing convictions going forward.
All right.
Well, thank you.
All right, thanks. I think we have – do we have another caller here? I'm not so sure. We're coming down here to the point where we have maybe about 5 minutes left in this part of Focus 580. We're talking with Simon Cole from the University of California, Irvine, from the Department of Criminology, Law, and Society there. Should we expect that on – basis of another kind of forensic evidence, that is DNA evidence, we're just going to see more and more challenges to past convictions based on that kind of evidence.
Challenges to past convictions using,
using
DNA evidence.
DNA evidence, yeah.
Well, the use of DNA evidence to challenge past convictions operates through what's been called a window. It has to be a certain kind of case that is recent enough that there is DNA evidence preserved that can be retested, but old enough that at the time the crime was initially prosecuted, the DNA evidence was not processed. So that's a kind of temporal window. And ever since the Innocence Project, which is the main group that's been known for doing this post-conviction DNA testing, started doing this, people have been predicting it's a limited window and it's going to close and eventually those cases are going to dry up. What's interesting is that they still have not dried up. We're at 240 some odd and counting, and I don't think the flow of those cases has slowed down. But eventually it must, and the use of DNA to investigate alleged wrongful convictions eventually must dry up. And innocence projects are then going to have to turn to the much more difficult work of investigating such cases without the kind of seeming magic bullet or truth machine of DNA. And that's more difficult, old-fashioned gumshoe work of re-interviewing witnesses and looking at old evidence and so on. So it's going to be quite challenging.
Yeah. Well, given that we do now have DNA and it is used as evidence in criminal trials, and that perhaps, you know, whether warranted or not, we have a high level of confidence in that, is there actually evidence to show that there are more cases where, let us say, someone is charged with a crime, and when confronted with the fact that there is this evidence, I mean, say that they're charged and say the prosecution says, look, here we've got this evidence, we've got DNA evidence to tie you to the crime. Is it now any more likely that that person would not even mount a defense, might be willing to try to make some kind of plea bargain rather than go all the way through the trial knowing that that evidence is present?
Sure. I think we should emphasize that the primary use of all of these forensic technologies that we've been talking about, fingerprints, DNA, even polygraphs, even confessions and interrogations, or not confessions, but the primary use of these technologies is to elicit confessions and plea bargains. Mm-hmm. That's primarily what they're used for. They're not used at trial. Over 95% or so of our cases are plea bargained anyway. So the primary use of these is to leverage other forms of evidence, which then save the state the expense of having of having a trial.
Well, and now is it more likely has DNA made that more likely, or has that really not changed that much?
Well, I don't know an empirical answer to that question, but I think DNA is probably functioning much as fingerprinting did for the past century, that if you went in and told somebody's lawyer, we've got some DNA evidence against your client, that's a pretty strong reason to plea bargain away. And one would hope they would hire their own expert, scrutinize the evidence, make sure everything is on the up and up. Mm. But that's going to be defense attorney. If they don't find any problems with the evidence, defense attorneys are not going to want to fight that at a trial. And they're going to advise their clients.
Does the fact that now that there is DNA and other kinds of sophisticated forensic evidence, and the fact that then if you're going to go to trial, then the defense may indeed have to be spending money to do its own investigation. You may have to pay someone to come in and testify as an expert witness for your defense. Has that raised perhaps even on both sides, I'm thinking particularly of the defense, but maybe overall, has that raised the cost of conducting a trial and conducting a defense?
Another good question that I don't know the answer to, but I wouldn't think it would, especially if it results – if it sort of smooths the path to plea bargains. We might think of this as a fairly – low-cost route to resolving cases, since criminal justice is not cheap in general. Paying attorneys and spending all the time filing briefs and producing paper and using judges' time and courthouses and so on. If two scientists can check the DNA results and come to agreement, that may in fact turn out to be an efficiency, especially as the cost of DNA drops. Yeah.
Let's get one more caller here quickly in Effingham, line 4. Hello.
Yes, on CNN just recently, I saw a middle-aged gentleman in tears being interviewed who had been charged with murder based on a dog who had taken the police to this man. And I found that to be very strange. And I wondered if you might know anything about that. I'll hang up and listen offline. Thanks.
Yeah, we're seeing an increasing amount of attention to dog scent cases, to dog sniffing and dog scent lineups as a forensic technology. I don't know if the caller was referring to the same case that I read about, which was a case in Texas. And the interesting thing about that case was that the person accused, it turns out falsely accused by the dog, was a police officer. And in fact, the dog matched to the police officer who lived near the victim of a crime, and it was this police officer who fought who fought against this evidence, and eventually DNA pointed to someone else, which has resonance with a famous fingerprint case in Scotland where the victim of what's believed to be an erroneous fingerprint match was also a police officer named Shirley McKee, who fought this erroneous match for many years and is fighting it still.
Well, we're going to have to stop there. We've come to the end of the time. For people, though, who are in and around Champaign-Urbana, if you'd like to hear more from our guest, Simon Cole from University of California, Irvine, he'll be talking on the topic Forensic Reality, CSI, Media, and Public Technoscience, part of the Center for Advanced Study Initiative, Interpreting Technoscience, Explorations in Identity, Culture, and Democracy. He talks this afternoon at 4 on the U of I campus in the Knight Auditorium at the Spurlock Museum on South Gregory in Urbana. Anybody who is interested can stop by. And again, the most recent book to which you contributed is?
It's called Truth Machine by Michael Lynch. Myself, Ruth McNally, and Kathleen Jordan out from University of Chicago Press.
And it's about DNA.
Yeah. It's about the DNA, yes, and a little bit about the impact of DNA on fingerprinting as well.
Thanks very much for being here. We appreciate it.
Thank you for having me.
Programs here on WILL are made possible with support from Sinfonia de Camera, presenting Tales of Shakespeare on Friday, October 9th, 7:30 p.m. in the Krannert Center for the Performing Arts. This homage to Shakespeare includes music from Tchaikovsky's Romeo and Juliet Fantasy to Cole Porter's Kiss Me, Kate. More information available at 333-6280. The broadcast is also made possible with support from The Sea Boat, featuring a southern style of cooking walleye and catfish, chicken, shrimp, sandwiches, and more. Available for dine-in and carry-out. The Sea Boat, 402 West Kirby, across from Jerry's IGA in Champaign. Catering services available at 355-9933. We will take a break at this point, as we usually do, so that we can bring you an update on the commodity markets and also on news. And then in the next part of Focus 580, we'll have here in our studio William Cohen, former U.S. Secretary of Defense. That was during the Clinton administration. He also was a senator and congressman from Maine. He's here visiting the campus, and we'll be talking about defense policy and a number of things, and hope you could stick with us. So again, right now, though, we'll take our usual break for an update on the markets, and please stay tuned.
Good morning, everyone. This is Dave Dickey with a look at the commodity markets, where at the Chicago Board of Trade, wheat is staging a rally, but the one I wanted to highlight today was the soybeans. It is staging a pretty significant rally, coming well above the short-term downtrend line that it broke under earlier in the week. November beans are now trading 933.5. They're up 21.5 on the day, and they are quickly approaching, if not exceeding, last week's highs. As I go ahead and look at the chart at the moment, I can see that we indeed at 934. Let's see, 919.25, the high last week, 937.25. So we're at 939 above last week's high, and that just happening in the last hour or so. Let's go ahead and catch you up on other particulars that are trading at the moment. January beans, 937.5, up 20.75. July, 941, up 20. December corn, 360.